Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Rafael Cormack about his work on the Arab Nakhda as popular entertainment, mass culture, and modernity in the Middle East. Welcome to the podcast, Rafael.
Hi, great. Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much, Rafael. Can we start maybe with that you tell us a bit about yourself, like where you are right now and how did you came to be there?
Right, yeah. Well, so physically where I am right now is the northeast of England. How I came to be here is I recently just started a job as assistant professor in Arabic in the modern languages department there. I did a PhD a while ago now on Egyptian theater. So that's kind of what I'm mostly interested in. My PhD was on actually adaptations of Oedipus in 20th century Egyptian theater. And I've been pursuing popular culture kind of in the Arab world as an area of research for a while now. I finished a book a little bit ago about, it was called Midnight in Cairo, sort of group biography, if you will, of the women of the 1920s and 1930s entertainment, theater, singing and dancing scene of Egypt. About that sort of in a very strange way came out of my PhD. And now I'm working on a little bit more entertainment stuff. Maybe we'll talk slightly later about the sort of current project that I'm just finishing up, which has been rather a strange one. And I'm here on the New Books Network from the northeast of England to talk about this edited collection that I put together with Helaoudi and Alaeddin Mahmoud. We'll talk again a little bit about how that came together. But basically, it's 9 scholars all writing on different aspects of popular culture in the 19th and 20th century, all shoved together into one edited collection.
Thank you so much, Rafael. And before we dive into the book, maybe you can tell us a bit about what the Nakhda actually is and what kind of period are we talking about and how it is connected to the region in general.
Right, yeah. And in fact, to answer that question, we're going to have to dive a bit into the book and our motivations for doing the book. Because, okay, what the Arab Nakhda is, or the Arabic Nakhda, depending on which way you want to put it, is kind of one of the, what that is one of the central questions of this book and the kind of first thing that really maybe propelled us to put this together. I mean, very broadly speaking, it is the time of cultural renaissance, so Nakhda, usually translated as renaissance, in the Arabic-speaking world that started in the 19th century and progressed at some point, some way into the 20th century. And I'd say probably over the past 10 or 20 years has become much more a subject of specific academic research. So okay, before 20 years ago, this was just the modern Arab world. But I think people have increasingly decided that, in fact, no, there was a movement called the Nakhda, the Renaissance, and there's something that we can study and we can look at it and we can draw it together with various other things. The question then becomes, well, okay, if this was some kind of movement, what did it look like? What things are included in the Nakhda? What is not included in the Nakhda? My sort of very basic background to it would be up to the one scholar who really kind of put together the Nahda as a topic of research first would be Albert Hourani, although he doesn't really use that word a lot. I don't want to say he doesn't use it, but in his book Arabic Thought in the Liberal Age. And without being too bald about it, his basic conception is the Nahda is this period in which the Arab world incorporates European liberal thought into its own tradition. And in his really excellent book, Arabic Thought in the Liberal Age, he goes through that. But since the publication of that, people have been questioning that as a framework of exactly what the Nahda is. Should we look at it like that? I mean, there's been lots of books. I mean, Arabic Thought in the was it? I'm going to now not remember the specific titles of any of them, but Jens Hansen and Max Weiss, they had a collection. Correct me on this too.
They had a collection about the Nahda out, exactly like two volumes of it, I think.
Yeah. And various other people, I don't know, Stephen Sheehy, Ziad Fahmy, Samah Saleem. Well, there's been a lot of people who've been writing about the Nahda a lot recently and maybe asking us to reconceptualize what is in itself quite a sort of broad brush conception, that the Nahda is just this period when European culture comes into the Arab world. In fact, it's something quite a lot more complicated than that, probably. And so, in asking, well, what is it? One thing you have to ask is, well, what does it contain? What things can we look at and point at and say, well, yes, that was the Nahda, which is now a very long-winded way of getting to one of the reasons for having this book. Normally, the things that people point out when they say this is the Nahda are printed texts, usually produced in Cairo or Beirut, high intellectual productions. And what we kind of wanted to ask was, okay, what would it look like to say the Nahda is in fact a popular culture movement? I mean, I'm not saying I'm asking everyone to come along with you and say, okay, let's forget all of these texts, but just, okay, what would it look like if we did say that? What kind of Nahda are we drawing if we just look at this popular culture? Is it picking up the same issues? Is it giving different answers to the questions that these big texts are asking? So yeah, that's a sort of long way around what is the Nahda, and a kind of introduction to a lot of the groundwork we were thinking about when we put together this collection.
Thank you so much, Raphael. And can you tell us about when the idea of this book project emerged and how did you three came together, basically, in order to work on the Arab Nahda?
It was actually, I think Alaeddin was the guy who holds most credit for putting it together, because he put together a Mesa panel a while ago, actually, and it was 2020. It must have been because it was COVID Mesa. I mean, subsequent Mesas have also been virtual, but this was the first one in which it was virtual. And it was him, me, Hella, and I think Thanat Shakhs, all giving papers on sort of similar things to what we talked about in this, although not exactly the same. I gave a paper on Munir al-Mahdiya, one of the kind of divas of Egypt's entertainment scene. But afterwards, he sort of got us together and said, how do you feel about turning this into something? To which we were, I think, both sort of vaguely keen, especially COVID, not having anything much else to do. And it was at that point then that we started to think, okay, if we are going to turn this into an edited collection of some time, what is this framework going to be? And that's when we started to think about this broader question of defining what the Nahda is. And so we brought in lots of people. I'm just trying to think about the best way to explain the articles that went into the book. So Hela, Aladdin, and me, we wrote to various people with this basic brief of, do you have anything related to popular culture and the NAFTA? And we saw what came in. And what came in was actually quite exciting. You know, there's lots of fun things, but it ranged from Till's, the first article opening this book, about cafes and cafe culture in this period. So not a kind of artistic production as such. I mean, some people are very artistic when they go to the cafe, but it's not quite the same as the theatre script. As alongside entertainment, so nightclubs, dancers, singers, music, I was particularly keen to get in there, cinema, and then Hela's got this article on the illustrations in the journals of the sort of the Nahdawi journals, which I think kind of encapsulates quite well some of what we're trying to do. Trying to say, well, okay, here are these journals that everyone agrees are one of the sort of the engine rooms of the late 19th century NAFTA. Everyone was making a journal, everyone was reading them, ideas were circulating. Well, and then so what Hela kind of asks is, well, okay, how were people actually consuming these things? And in fact, the pictures in them may have been in many cases just as important. Perhaps people don't read, or for people who are looking at them, just, you know, passing them by on the shelf or in a cafe. The pictures are just as important as the texts themselves. Why haven't we been looking at these things? So she brings some of that out. So it came from this Mesa panel, but then really it came from the discussions that we were having afterwards, trying to figure out how we would turn a panel into a book like this.
And as you mentioned, there are a lot of scholars involved in the book that you edited together with the other twos. And how hard was it for you to choose the people for the book that worked on the articles? And how hard was it to find the right articles for this kind of book project? Because it looks at a particular issue of the Arab Nahda. So, yes, that was what interests me.
Yeah, I mean, very, very hard is the short answer. But the long answer is, well, I think partly what we were trying to do with this book is open up as many conversations as is possible, as opposed to sort of giving definitive answers. I mean, as I said earlier on, it's a slightly provocative question to say, okay, what would we say if the Arab Nahda was popular entertainment? What would that look like? And then, so we wanted to give as many sort of possible avenues into that, which includes, I think, both geographic as well as a generic diversity. So we were very keen to get in. I was particularly keen to get stuff in on music, because I think that's a very key part of a lot of the cultural production that was going on in the early 20th century, late 19th century. And so to bring that into the conversation was important to me. And then we had Liz Matsushita. She came in and who works on Andalusi music in North Africa. North Africa, too. I think it's very important to try and ask why the NAFTA is so often confined to, let's say, Cairo and Beirut, and then the sort of peripheries of both of those two cities. What does it look like in North Africa, as well as Iraq? So Pelle Valentin Olsen was doing a piece. I had heard Diana Abeni talk before on the female entertainers of Beirut. I was particularly keen to get in because she gave a great talk and I really liked it. But what she has done is really she's found in this magazine, this Beiruti magazine, Arsifa, a lot of just one-page biographies of female singers, dancers, sometimes actresses, but mostly singers and dancers lesser known ones, you know, not the big celebrities, the sort of day-to-day jobbing female performers. And what she's uncovered is some really interesting stuff about how questions of gender, what a woman's role is in the sort of new public society, what a kind of ideal woman, and also sort of what the mirror image of a woman kind of is, but all told, at least theoretically, and I think probably largely through accounts actually delivered by these female performers themselves. I mean, no doubt perhaps edited for the magazine, but through their voice. So it seemed to me that this again is a sort of another key thing that we're trying to do with this collection. Okay, feminism and the rise of sort of female participation in the public sphere is another huge issue of the Nahda, extremely important one from the late 19th till the early 20th century, and then so forth, but usually one that has been told through textual sources, partly because that's just one of the sort of most standard ways in which you tell any history, and partly because, okay, recovering anything else is very difficult. But so Diana Burney has found this exciting kind of textual source that hints at something much larger and tries to then put some of those debates that we recognize as central debates of this period, of modern Arab history, of the rise of feminism, but put them into a popular culture lens and sort of see what comes out when you refract them.
Thank you so much, Raphael. And the articles in the book that are looking at the Nahda are looking at it from different angles and different perspectives. You talked about this already a little bit, but how does this book in particular situate itself in the current landscape of the Nahda studies in general?
Yeah, it's a good question, and we do address it somewhat in the introduction. But it's hard to say very definitively because, of course, we all have our own slightly different views about this. And my own views have been formed by conversations with Helene Aladdin, so I don't want to speak for them, but equally I'm not probably only speaking for myself. When I say this, I think, well, one central text for the study of popular culture and the Nahda is Ziad Fahmy's Ordinary Egyptians, which, I don't know, it must be 10 or 15 years old by now, but in which he sort of says, he sort of asks a similar question to us, in which, okay, what does this period of history look like when told through popular sources? What we feel we're doing slightly differently from him is he, at least so my feeling is, sort of separates these popular sources outside of the Nahda slightly. They're kind of competitors to the Nahda. They're not necessarily part of it. They're a different history, a kind of almost a contrapuntal history. Whereas what we tried to do with this collection is say, well, as I've said now many times, and I'll just say it again, okay, well, what if the Nahda is popular entertainment? This is not just something that's separate from the Nahda. This is a part of it. And my article in this book is sort of trying to gesture a little bit towards that. So my article is about traveling theater troupes who, in the late 19th and early 20th century, both traveling in the Egyptian countryside, but also traveling between Egypt and other countries in the Middle East. But it sort of starts off from the observation made based also on work by Peter Hill and his work on Telemach, that in fact, perhaps a lot of these Nahda texts would have been more known as theatrical productions than they would have been known as books. To take the example of Telemach, the French epic that was then translated by Tahtawi in the mid-19th century and became a sort of one classic example of an early Nahd. Perhaps some people want to fit it into the history of the genesis of the Arabic novel, or it's an epic, or it's just an example of translation of a French text into Arabic culture. Whatever it is, it's a kind of seminal Nahd text. But in the late 19th century, there were all these different theatrical adaptations of it. And so, as I say, people probably encountered it much more as a play than they did as a book. And this is perhaps true of various other sort of translations. So Walter Scott's Talisman was turned into a very famous play. Shakespeare, of course, like, okay, people weren't reading Shakespeare, they were seeing it performed. Not performed always in direct translations. There are quite loose translations sometimes, did a lot with the texts. And then not only were those plays performed in Cairo, Alexandria, Beirut, they were also performed in these Egyptian countryside settings. And so both Tawfiq al-Hakim and Yusuf Wahbi, one a writer, the other an actor, who are big in the early to mid 20th century, in their memoirs, they describe at the very beginning of the 20th century that both of them first encountered Fen, or art, as they called it, in one of these traveling theater performances there. And that's something that I would like to do more work on. It's hard to find the sources for that, or exactly the approach of how to do it. That's something I'm sort of thinking about now. But what it does is allow you to ask that question, not just, okay, here's the Nahd on one side and here's popular culture on the other side, but how are these two things interacting and changing each other and all of that kind of stuff. So that's point number one, I suppose. And then point number two, okay, how this all fits into the study of the Arab Nahd. And this, I think, more is probably a little bit more my own view. So one thing we did is include a film, at least the last chapter. The next chapter is on the early Egyptian film industry, about national formation and Zainab. Now, one central question of the Nahd, at least so far as I see it, is, okay, if we've identified it as a thing, a movement, when does it start and when does it end? Which becomes actually not a very easy question to answer, but one which forces you to really say, well, okay, what was the Nahd? I think most people would agree, okay, probably if we're going to date the start of it, it's likely to be the early 19th century. Perhaps we say the founding of the Bulaq Press in 1821. We can always go earlier and earlier if we want. We can perhaps push it back to sort of the very beginning. Peter Hill, who I'll reference again, found these the translations of the Damietta Circle, which is this group of Greek to Arabic translators who are working in 1800 or so. So maybe we say, okay, we can already see some things that we might define as Nahdawi by around 1800. But we're going to say, okay, most people will agree that it's around the early 19th century, and then it really gets going in the mid-19th century. And by the end of the 19th century, we're definitely in it. There's no question. But when it ends becomes a slightly more difficult question to answer. Is film a project of the Nahd, or is that too modern? And it depends, I think, how you construct what the Nahd is. So Hurani goes up to 1939. A lot of people would perhaps go up to, say, like, really the hard end is, I don't know, the early 1950s, late 1940s, because that's decolonization. And if you say that, well, then you say, well, is the Arab Nahd, is it really a movement which is a reaction to or somehow inextricably linked to colonialism in the Arab world. Those dates would seem to suggest that it is. My view, if I was forced to be pinned down and take one, would be to follow, I think, Samah Saleem, who basically constructs the Nahda as a reaction to capitalism or global capitalism in some way, which again, of course, is very tied to colonialism, but maybe is not exactly the same thing. I think she calls it the colonialism from which there is no, or the empire from which there is no outside, or something like that. She quotes Mignola. And this is a long-winded way, but I am going to get somewhere to say, okay, if we see the Nahda really as in some way a symptom of the spread of capitalism in the 19th and 20th century, then again, popular entertainment seems to be an extremely logical and kind of productive place to go, because the popular entertainment of the 19th and 20th centuries in Egypt. Okay, of course, popular entertainment existed before the 19th and 20th centuries in Egypt, but the entertainment of that time is so inextricably linked to capitalism too. I mean, it's the result of the fact that people can, in the case of theater and the music hall, which I'm more interested in, it's the fact that people have money to spend going to music halls. Setting up a music hall business is kind of a viable way to go in terms of a capitalist means of economy. You've got the guy who's running it. Quite often he's Greek, so that's a sort of, not always, but that's a sort of stereotype. So that's a kind of connection with global capital there. And he's making money selling alcohol at an inflated price and all the rest of it. So if the Nahda is a kind of reaction to capitalism, popular entertainment is definitely a place where we can see it, because we can see it there a lot.
Thank you so much, Raphael. And you mentioned earlier that you started working on the book during the COVID pandemic. And did you had any, can you remember that if there were any difficulties or the challenges working on the book during the period, like maybe not getting access to some archives that you like maybe wanted to use, or finding the right resources? Like, is there anything that you can remember of?
The biggest difficulty was trying to get us three together to talk about it and schedule it as well. We were on sort of all on different time zones. At the beginning, Hella was in Beirut, and her internet was very patchy, as well as like various other things also going on at the time. Aladdin was in Kuwait, and at first I was in America, I think. So there was that time zone kind of coordination. I found actually over the pandemic, libraries were so generous with scanning things and digitizing materials sort of on an ad hoc basis that we were really helped by that, actually. And I remember this is actually for another book I was working on, the American University in Beirut. I said, oh, I really need to see this book. And then they just went off and scanned the requisite parts and said, here you go, see you later. Some archive in New Zealand also sent me some letter without even me asking them to do it.
And you said already that music is kind of the thing that interested you the most on the book project, kind of. And what were the most striking article for you that stand out in the book, kind of, that are characterizing the Nahda in the best way?
Yeah, oh, good question. Well, the article on music that I bring out would be Liz Matsushita's article on Andalusi music in North Africa. And just, I think what that helps do is to ask these central questions that we've been thinking about of, okay, what makes something part of the Nahda? Is it, what's the cultural influences of all of this? So there's that. Pelle Olsen's article on Baghdad was very interesting to me, who knows really not that much about the entertainment history of Baghdad. And I think Pelle is hopefully working on some more of that. But it's more, that article is more of a kind of walk through the early stages of the entertainment scene in Iraq. And what I am interested in, I think, with popular culture is what the different answers it can give you to these big questions that everyone is interested in. So posing the same questions to popular culture. And what this article does very well is, and I think what it ties quite nicely with Diana Burney's article, which comes right after it, is ask these questions about these big questions about gender that we've been asking ourselves. And in the case of Pelle, he talks about the kind of gender fluid performers of the early 20th century too in Iraq and what's going on there. I think maybe performance is a good place to look at gender too. Perhaps will give you interesting and different insights to looking at texts. So I think those two together, Pelle, Diana's, and then Liz's also all come together to show how performance and music can give you these sort of slightly different answers, slightly unexpected answers to questions about what is gender for someone in the early 20th century Arab world. What are their concerns about it? How are they thinking things through?
Thank you so much, Raphael. And coming to the last question, how is Darab Nahda connected in any way to your next projects that you are working on, or the period in general? That you are you still going to work on the Nahda, or which time frame are you looking at right now?
Yeah, well, once we can figure out what the Nahda is, then maybe I will. So what I'm actually kind of just finishing up now, although I just a couple of days ago had an idea which maybe I'll put out into the world if anyone wants to help me with it. No, is that so? I'm just finishing up a project on kind of spiritualism and hypnotism and stage mystics, half in the Arab world. So a lot of the early spiritualists of the Arab world and the hypnotist boom of the early 20th century, and also partly in Europe, focusing on one guy who was an Armenian refugee from Istanbul and ended up in Europe in the 1920s as a kind of big Eastern sheikh, sort of Orientalist fantasy. So that's him. But the spiritualists and the hypnotists of the Arab world are really connected to the Nahda. I mean, they're inseparable from the Nahda. It's all about, particularly interestingly, spiritualism comes into the Arab world as largely a religious reformist, sort of on the back of religious reformist movements. So Tantawi Gohri, who's a big Egyptian sheikh, and Muhammad Farid Waghdi, also a sort of slightly more westernized, if you want to use that word, Egyptian Islamic intellectual. They're both fascinated with science and how modern science can be reconciled with Islam, or how Islam can benefit from modern science, and equally actually how Islam kind of prefigures a lot of the things that modern science has discovered. So they say that, well, you know, really the Quran got there first and you guys are just catching up. And one of the things that's part of this big project, especially for Gohri but also for Waghdi, is spiritualism. And when I say spiritualism, I mean the science of summoning the spirits of the dead from the other world, from the next life. And they organize these sort of seances in 1920s Cairo. Gohri actually writes a book because he's been he's contacted at one of these seances the Khalifa Harun al-Rashid, who tells him to write write this specific book, and he does. So it all goes, it's slightly wacky, some of it, but equally really tied to this idea of the progress of modern science and how it relates to Islam and the rest of the Arab world and the Muslim world. So in that sense, it's sort of another fundamentally Nahdawi project in some way. But then what comes, and then I think maybe this is what I've just been thinking about recently, and this maybe also is a fundamentally Nahdawi project, is lots of, should we call them charlatans, sort of larger than life stage hypnotists who take lots of money off people in return for some slightly wacky stunts, contacting the dead and all of this kind of stuff. And there's this big in the 20s and 30s, which I would say probably is still in the Nahda bracket, there's a big sort of charlatan panic about, oh, well, who are all these people, which stretches in various different directions of, you know, who are these hypnotists, also who are these jinn summoners. And so I wonder if perhaps that can be extended, and the early 20th century in the Arab world, or at least should we say actually in Egypt, is this time of charlatanry, and everyone's talking about charlatanry, not only these hypnotists but other people too. And there's people who come back from Europe with these fake degrees, there's lots of frauds around, there's these guys setting up fake banks and taking checks out of everyone, and then taking their money and never giving them the money back because the bank is fake. And there's all these kinds of little stories like that. And to bring it back slightly circularly, maybe not all the way in the circle, but a slightly pleasing mini circle, to Sama Salim's conception of the Nahda as really capitalism in a sense, and the reflections of that. I wonder if there's something about early 20th century capitalism in its, at least in its iteration in Egypt and the rest of the Arab world, which somehow seems to everyone inherently fraudulent. There's something, this idea of fraudulence and, you know, maybe the Nahda is a fraud. Like that's the next thing I'm exploring. This is half-baked because I only came up with it a few days ago, but it's trying to draw together this idea that there's so many sort of con men and charlatans operating in the early 20th century in Egypt, that maybe there is some underlying kind of anxiety about fraud that can tie them all together.
Thank you so much, Raphael, for joining us today to the podcast. And thank you so much for your time being with us today here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.